Hello, everyone, and welcome to the next edition of the VTX podcast. Here at the Veterinary Thought Exchange, we like to start by asking, what are you thinking? And this week, we're going to be thinking and chatting with the amazing Dr. Kelly Gelhouse. Kelly works as a veterinarian in shelter medicine in Minnesota in the US. We talked to her about going abroad to study. So she studied veterinary medicine over in the UK in Edinburgh, and how she then found her way back to the US and into shelter medicine, and navigating the challenges that come along with that, not only for her patients, but for her owners too. We dive into what makes each veterinary professional individual, and the feeling of knowing when you find your niche, and being able to work in this industry with real passion. So really excited to talk to her today. In our clinical segment, we're going to start a series of chats about leptospirosis, which is an exciting topic and one that we definitely are faced with in day-to-day clinical practice. So I do hope you enjoy that too. Okay, so Kelly, thanks so much for joining us. For so many reasons, I think we'll get you to introduce yourself to the listeners. But from my own point of view, it's lovely because we have connected through, our postgraduate stuff through VTX and things. But I think more importantly, our paths crossed when you were in the UK. So we can maybe kind of touch a little bit on that a little bit. But just maybe to start for the listeners, just introducing yourself and maybe a little bit about your veterinary background.
Yeah, so my name is Kelly Gelhouse. And I, for as long as I can remember, actually, I worked in the veterinary field, starting with, cleaning kennels at a young age and just kind of immersed myself into the field. And I was the classic, always wanted to know, I always wanted to be a vet ever since I was young. And I still think going back to my 7-year-old self, would say the same thing. But anyway, so then the reason I ended up in the UK was because both my now husband and I, he wasn't my husband at the time, but we both applied to vet school at the same time. So in the States, it's very difficult to get into vet school. Not that it's not in the UK, but there's not a lot of vet schools. And so we kind of expanded our options by applying overseas, and we both got in. So that landed us over there. And I graduated, oh gosh, when was that now? Like, it was 2015. Did I graduate?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Because
you were,
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Crossed, so.
So you and your husband are both vets. Were you thinking that he might be your husband before you applied to vet school, or were you not together? You were together then.
We were together. Yeah. People always think we met in vet school because that's where a lot of, people meet. And I guess the husbands are snatched up quickly because there's not many of them.
That's so true. Thank you. So, yeah, you were lucky to get him before.
I went in. Yeah. I held on to him throughout, which was surprising given our different study habits. But anyway, we actually met in Australia in a study abroad program.
Oh, wow.
For undergrad. Yeah. So we met there and we were just like, oh, this is fun and casual. And then kind of made the long distance thing work. And then what brought us to actually be together was going to vet school. So,
okay.
So we both got in, to University of Edinburgh, and we were so excited to be able to, so fortunate to both be able to go to vet school together.
So wait a minute, he's American, is he?
Yes, yeah, he's from Connecticut, yeah.
So how did you, you ended up in Australia just randomly, sort of separately?
Yeah, so we just signed up for study abroad programs he went to school in California, and I had gone to school in Pennsylvania in our undergrads, and ended up in Australia, so there we are.
How random is that? And then, so actually, quite a sort of test for a relationship, I think, to then go to vet school together. And did you live together during that time?
We did.
We had
stayed at each other's respective parents' homes before, visiting each other. So we knew there was, an understanding of how each other, were at home. Mm-hmm. Living together. But yeah, it was quite a, I don't think looking back that we realized how hard it was going to be initially. We were just like, oh yeah, we're just going to vet school in another country, and it'll be fine. And we've never lived together officially. So, yeah.
But I do. I think that's, yeah, I think there's a bravery there, actually. And I think maybe some, maybe a naivety as well. So I think.
Well, and we actually had, we lived with another classmate our first year. So I feel like she was like a good buffer, and she was, became one of our best friends and was in our wedding. So.
Okay, good. Yeah. Okay. And so obviously things work out because you're married now and you have a child. So that's okay.
So we all, we got through it. We survived.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're both still doing the vet thing.
Good. No, that's good. So you, so then take us, so you, you obviously moved back to the US after spending a wondrous four years in Scotland, obviously. Yeah, right. It's a good, Scotland's a good place, right?
Well, we pretty much talk about on the regular how much we miss it, especially in this day and age, but you know, we really do. But yeah, so we landed back here and both started our careers as general practice vets. And we kind of just randomly took, I took a job in Utah. I have no family in Utah. We just went to Utah and he got a job there as well. And we were there for a few years. And then what actually brought us, so we're in Minnesota now, Minnesota, they say.
Oh, yes. I love that accent. Yeah. Okay.
I hear it come out now that I've lived here a couple of years. But yeah, so he got a residency here at the university. So he, he's a resident now for pathology.
Oh, listen, he's a smart guy. He is a smart guy. Listen, I didn't know that. That's really, really interesting. My now resident, isn't that funny to say? So my resident now, she is currently, as we speak, she's doing her pathology externship. So she's with a, you know, pathology department as part of her internal medicine training. And she was like, this is the right decision, because actually, so I'm not being disrespectful to, like, it's not like it's easy or anything like that at all. But actually, I do think that some of the disciplines afford certain freedoms from having to deal with clients.
Yeah, I don't think he misses that at all, which is funny, 'cause it's one of my favorite things about being.
But isn't that, so let's talk, that's so interesting you say that. So there, so I'm you know, I'm saying that tongue in cheek, and I'm not meaning that in a sort of a mean way, but I'm saying that, you know, one of the things that causes some of the challenge to our, you know, to our job is definitely to do with the fact that interacting with people is challenging, and it doesn't matter what profession you're in, but vets will resonate listening to this, saying, look, dealing with clients is hard. But that's, so you say that is still one of the better parts of your job for you?
It is. And I think, and I've been fortunate enough now to where I'm at a nonprofit organization where, you know, we, money is still a main topic of conversation. But at the same time, like, people aren't coming and screaming at me saying I'm overcharging them for things, you know, that aren't necessary, which is a reality in our world, unfortunately. You know, things we recommend cost money to protect and care for pets. But I've always just really enjoyed, like, talking to people, you know, getting to know people, and especially the human animal bond. And so, you know, just to be able to help a pet through helping their person as well, it's just, I don't know, it's always been something, not to sound, I don't know how to put this without sounding like full of myself, but it's always been something I was good at, was talking to people. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people go to vet school and want to be a vet because, like, oh, well, I love animals so much. And I do. I mean, I was always pretending to be an animal as a child. So, like,
that's a different thing. I don't think that's, is that, did you get some counseling for that? Well, I don't know.
Later in life.
Yeah, later on, yeah.
But anyway, so, like, the love for animals is there, but also the love for, you know, just getting to know people and talk to people is also there. And being able to help them through helping their pet. So, yeah.
Can you just, so I'm interested, actually, because I think you one of the things that you talk about working for a non-profit organization, and actually potentially for some of our listeners, well, a lot of our listeners in the UK, I wonder whether we just need a bit of clarity about what that means, because I think in the UK we're used to private veterinary practice, which is private veterinary practice, and that's what it is, and it, they are profitable, ultimately, organizations, particularly, well, not particularly with the corporatization, but ultimately there's no, we're not shying away from the fact that veterinary, you know, veterinary practices do make profit. And then we have charities. So we have the PDSA and the RSPCA and the SSPCA, which are charitable organizations. And although actually now the PDSA have changed their structure a bit, and there is some the clients are charged some money for the services, just explain to us then what a non-profit is, and where does that fit into the veterinary sphere in the US?
Yeah, so it is a nonprofit organization here in Minnesota called Animal Humane Society. So it's separate from the Humane Society, which most people would be familiar with. And I was so fortunate to get involved with them, which is a whole nother story. But essentially, we provide through donations and fundraisers, things like that, and grants, we can help to subsidize payments for owners as far as, you know, what it costs for them for veterinary care. So what it looks like essentially is that you do have to qualify for okay. services. And the clinic is in a community that it's actually, I live six blocks away from the clinic, which is great. But it's a very diverse community of all different sort of backgrounds and incomes and things like that. So we see various people come in, and we have the sliding scale where you can qualify for like reduced minimum or standard payments. And so it's like our baseline is our standard. So, you know, we'll just use easy numbers, which is not true. It's $50, say, for an exam. And then, you know, minimum will qualify for like 50% off. So it's only $25 for an exam instead. So you have to show proof of, like, you know, we're talking like social security, disability. So, you know, they bring documents that just kind of prove that they're maybe going through tough times financially. And then we're able to help their pets still because they couldn't afford otherwise a private practice. That makes sense.
Yeah, it completely does. And I think it's not massively dissimilar actually to the kind of the PDSA model within the UK. What I must admit, and I'm maybe showing my ignorance, if I'm being very honest about this, I think that my perception of the healthcare system across the board in the US, that it was not as forgiving as you've just described. And I wasn't really aware of maybe that kind of facility being sort of available in the same way as it maybe was in the UK. Because I think that certainly from an outward perspective, looking into the US, healthcare is contentious across the board because it's, you know, it seems like it's just big dollar much of the time, and there's a lot of stress on people with their own healthcare provision, and certainly, you know, again, as an outsider looking into the election processes within the US, healthcare is always a very contentious point, right? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like
we can say it's a hot mess.
It's fine. Okay. I'm actually really interested in American politics generally, but I don't want to, it's not my place to have a, I'm not an American citizen, so I don't feel like I can have a too much of an opinion. But I think what there's two things actually that I think that are interesting about that. I've heard many people say that working in the UK, because we have the NHS, mm-hmm. then actually one of the challenges when we're facing people with bills for their animal care is that they're like, what? Like, how can it be? And then we've got this kind of backtracking. Well, actually, if you were to pay for a cesarean on the NHS, it would cost £10,000, and actually your £2,000 cesarean and your French bulldog's quite a good deal. I'm simplifying. So actually there's this idea that potentially working in the US, because people are used to the numbers associated with healthcare, then actually maybe some of that financial conversation is less challenging. But equally, there are obvious challenges with the fact that healthcare is monetized in the way that it is in the US. Do you think is that fair? Do you think?
I wish I could say people were more understanding about the bills or estimates that they would receive from us. And I don't think they are, which is, it's a great point to bring up because, yeah, I mean, well, I guess for instance, you know, we have our health insurance, like it comes out of my paycheck, right? And it's going somewhere and I don't see it. But then like if we had to unfortunately take Charlotte, our kiddo, to the hospital a few months ago, and we just got the bill, and I'm like, oh, it's good that the insurance is doing something, because it's like, you know, $7,000, but we still owe $600, right? So I'm like, well, why? But you know, I look at it, and you know, I actually, when I had her, we got slapped with a massive bill, and I look at it, I'm like, this seems like way too much. Like, I have insurance, like, why am I owing thousands of dollars? And so I called them and I said, this seems, you know, incorrect. And they were just like, oh yeah, okay, don't pay it right now, we'll look into it. It was very like blasé, like just, it's fine, don't pay it now. And it turns out they hadn't put it through the insurance before sending me the bill. And I just think I could have just sat here and not paid it, and like nothing really happened. But also you have folks that get those bills and they don't think anything. They're like, oh, this must be how much I owe, and they'll just pay it without calling. Whereas I was like, no, this seems not right. So I was like that client, you know, can you give me an itemized receipt of what yeah. we just did? But anyway, it's beyond my comprehension, even in trying to understand it. It's just, like I said, it's kind of it seems like a hot mess, but okay. I try to understand it as best I can.
We're not here to solve that problem. So no, I think I wish no, I could. Please, yeah, let's not try yeah. doing that. So you talked about obviously your husband doing a residency, and I think, you know, the idea that lots of people will be dragged around places because people are doing residencies. So I've, you know, that's an age old story. My other half is doing a bloody residency somewhere and I'm gonna have to go. So was that the case? Did you go to the place for the residency, or did you guys decide to move? I wish I could do the accent. Minnesota. Yeah, so did you decide to go there for other reasons?
No, it was very much for the residency. We were having a fairly good time in Utah, but when he was applying, he wanted to apply because he did want to go to obviously do anatomical pathology and go to one of the vet schools. And there were a few places that I said, absolutely not, I will not move there.
Can I ask what those places were?
Florida, Texas. not that I have anything against anyone that, well, friends that I have known that have lived there or live there, or family. Okay. But I just said, I'm not doing that.
Okay. Let's not crack that open. I love that.
We ended up here in Minnesota, as they say it. And I was okay with that. I mean, because I love winter. I love the snow. And it gets to like negative 40 Fahrenheit here, which I've forgotten how to convert to Celsius from moving back here. But anyway, it gets very, very cold. Polar freezes, or vortexes, they call it. But it's otherwise been lovely. You know, people here have been great, and we didn't have any friends or family here. We just came for the residency. So that was a fun challenge.
And was your idea, did you have this passion for working in this particular sort of sector of veterinary medicine, with this kind of with this charitable kind of part of it, that you was that something that you specifically wanted to do?
It was always something that I was always interested in shelter medicine initially after going through vet school and graduating, but I just felt like mentally I couldn't do it, just with how much it's a whole different ball game with that. So I did end up I was working for a corporation, one of the corporate veterinary clinics, and in Utah before we moved. And so I took a position within that same corporation, just because it was easy, to be honest, just to transfer from Utah to here and have everything be the same, health insurance and such. So, so I started off with that, and I really loved my clients that I gained, but it wasn't going well for me. So like mentally, I was just having a hard time. So then I actually, one of my friends from our year sent me a link to a job actually at the University of Minnesota, where Chris is, and it was for a teaching position for a community clinic through the Animal Humane Society. And I applied for that, got through some interviews, got to the main like selection committee, had the interview in the back of a car on my way to a wedding because that was the only time I can make it work. And then, funny enough, didn't get that job because probably that
because you were drunk. No, I'm joking.
We were just on our way. They hadn't, at first they were like, are you driving? And I was like, oh no. So anyway, I didn't get that job, but one of the, essentially the head of the nonprofit here, Animal Humane Society, which is a shelter and this community clinic that they run, reached out to me. He's like, I think you should apply for our position instead. And then I did, and then I got it. So, it was such a fantastic transition to, again, not that I have anything against the, you know, corporations, you know, with the vet clinic world, but just to be able to go from that sort of sector to then nonprofit was just, I mean, it was a game changer. And they're all about quality of life for their staff as well and work-life balance, which, you know, it's a pretty, I think it's rare to find, you know, is that being top priority. So I was so happy. I don't think I'd ever been happier to not get a position because it landed me to where I am. And I still actually get to work with students and stuff because they come to our clinic to do their community clinic, essentially rotation. And I'm quite close with the girl who got the job instead of me. And I'm so happy I didn't get the job.
I love it. But yeah. doesn't it all work out for a reason? So would you say that you're happy in the job that you have?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's such a fantastic team and everyone's there for, you know, the same reasons. You know, we want to be able to help these folks that otherwise can't, you know, they could barely, you know, as we kind of pointed out before, they probably can't afford nor do they have healthcare for themselves, but their pets are their absolute lives. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they have no other resources. And so I've had clients actually tell me like, well, I can't afford food for myself today, but I can pay for the visit today, you know? And so that's been, which I'm sure you maybe had seen it at the PDSA as well. You know, people are just so willing to do whatever it takes for their animal, even though they might not have the funds to do so.
And I've, controversially or not, and I don't mind, I'll say whatever. I mean, it's my opinions, you know, I'm going to say it. It's my podcast. I'll say what I like. No, I'm joking. I have said before, and I really truly believe, like, I don't believe, I think that I know there's a lot of kind of narrative about, you know, pets are a luxury and all that kind of stuff. And I get that a bit, but actually I do not in any way think that people that maybe do not have all the resources that X, Y, and Z do should be denied ability to have a pet. And I think, you know, we've spoken, and there's an organization within the UK called Street Vet, and they are a charitable veterinary organization that help the pets of homeless people within the UK. And actually gets me a little bit emotional, but I think that you know, they're dealing with people who are in some of the lowest parts of their life, and actually the only thing that keeps them alive sometimes is the animals that they have, and so it's really hard to not justify that person having that animal as long as they are, you know, obviously caring for them. We don't want animal welfare to be affected, but equally it's really hard to just be dictatorial and say if you don't have enough money you cannot have X, Y, and Z. You know, I'm not sure that it's black and white like that.
No, absolutely not. And we even have this program in place. I mean, we're not meant to use it every day, but, you know, based on our, you know, what we're presented with, if an owner is unable to pay, and I've had a few cases like this now where the animal needs some pretty critical care or what have you, and they can't pay, they have no money. And so we do surrender prevention where, or on a select few cases, we're able to say, all right, that's fine. You don't have any, you know, pay what you can today, whether it's $1 or $50, but we're going to go ahead and do everything that we need to do to help the animal. So that's been really cool because I think I was kind of doing that anyway at other jobs. But
I love that.
Now it's recognized.
I literally, full disclosure, I've been doing this my whole career, but you just didn't know. And I don't care because you were a big corporation, you got loads of money anyway. So,
my favorite thing that I would do would, you know, if I have a vomiting puppy come in and, you know, people are like, well, I can't pay for this. And I don't want to pay for the x-rays or whatever. Usually it was because they were like, oh, I can't afford it. I'd be like, oh, well, you know, I accidentally dropped the dog carefully onto the table and I tripped and fell onto the pedal. Oh, but we got these great images.
Listen, no.
My accidental x-ray.
We used to do, oh my goodness, the number of teaching things that I did. Like, I was like, it's a godsend to have a student because we can just put this through as a teaching opportunity.
I still stop, like, don't charge for ear cytologies, I feel like, these days, because I make, if I have a student with me, I'm like, oh, here's a great learning opportunity. Go read this while I'm finished, you know, talking to the client or whatever. So it's kind of, it's not like we nickel and dime, but, you know, it's.
And that's the thing, like, I think we're, you know, and I've been so conditioned for years working for, you know, big organizations who, you know, there's plenty of money. And I think I'm comfortable charging what we're charging. But I think, honestly, working in that kind of environment where you, I don't know, maybe it's a bit naughty, but I think at the end of the day, if you can do these things that are just, at the end of the day, I believe just the right thing to do, then just do it. Why not? Yeah, do you know what I mean? I think, but I think it's wonderful to find it. What we've done a lot in the podcast actually is chat to people about their careers and the chat, as you'll be aware, sort of a lot of the challenges. And what I really like is the fact that it's all about, for me, sort of finding your spot, you know. And I think people, you know, and if you can, in this kind of with the Humane Society type sort of thing, if you can find your lane, which kind of just, you know, brings all the things you like, you know, to give you kind of joy in your career, then I think that's just the most important thing. And we're all, you know, we all are, although we're all veterinary surgeons, we're all built in slightly different ways, you know, so we're not all destined to be internal medicine specialists or pathology residents, or, you know, we're all, do you know what I mean? Like, it's all important that we're also very different within this field. So it's really nice to hear that you've kind of found joy in that. Great to hear. And I think really we talk a lot about the negatives of the profession on the podcast, and I think it's really nice to hear about some of the positives. I don't know if you want to share, if you have things, you know, that spring to mind as particularly kind of positive experiences that you've had within your time in your current position.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and just going off of that, not to go away from the question, but, you know, when you were saying that, I was nodding my head thinking, like, I absolutely love this job, and I know I'm where I'm supposed to be right now, and it brings me so much joy. But that being said, I have to do a lot more surgery than I ever wanted to do, because we do high volume spay neuter. So, you know, you're never going to have like that perfect, you know, there's always going to be, I think, a struggle. And that's just like with anything, right? But I'm so honest and open about it. And I even tell, like, when I have students watching me do spay neuter, I kind of say, well, maybe don't watch me. You know, I'm supposed to be doing this like very efficiently. And, you know, we do the high volume, high quality spay neuter. And so that's still like a scary place for me. And I always say I'm not a surgeon, even though it's tough because general practitioners are expected to do it all, aren't they? I would love to just see consults and talk to people and do more internal medicine and such things. But, you know, this particular organization, you know, we are like in most general practices having to do it all. I kind of just make sure that I tell students, like, you know, if you don't like doing surgery, that's okay. Or if you're not into medicine, that's okay. You know, find a place that lets you flex your muscles and what you want to do.
But I think also, actually, you make a good point, though, because, okay, you're willing to make that surgery sacrifice because you're in a job that you love. But actually, one of the things that I think generally has to change about the profession in order to get people to stay, I think, honestly, what we're going to have to do is be more willing to accommodate that. You know, so you come to the job interview and I say to you, right, so what is it that you want to do? And you're like, actually, I'd much rather just consult and do X, Y, and Z. And I'd be like, perfect. Because I've got this other guy or girl who all they want to do is surgery. And actually, I've spoken to many people who are like that. So let's get you guys together and let's make that work. But I think unless we're willing to be like dramatically more flexible with people's wants and needs, then we are going to continue to hemorrhage people from the profession. Do you know what I mean? And so actually you're like Goldust. Yeah, she wants to consult. Other people hate that. Like, what? Get her in.
Yeah, most of the vets at this place, like, they love doing surgery. They don't want to talk to the clients. And I'm like, no, that's, like, I would do that five days a week of my work week. And most of the others would say, maybe one here and there I can handle. And I'm like, no, let me do it. And so.
I love it. But there you go.
They want to let me do it, but they also want to make sure I still am keeping, up, like, my surgical skills intact in case it's needed. But, yeah, and just to, I mean, one of the biggest moments for me in this past, because I've only been there a year now. So I got this opportunity and this job during the pandemic, which was absolutely amazing. And I think it was my first week or so there, I was calling back on some labs for somebody else. And the dog was diagnosed, they diagnosed the dog as diabetic. And I was like, all right, like, how do we do glucose curves and things like that here? Like trying to figure out like, oh, how do you guys do this here? Like, this is how I've done it. And they were like, oh yeah, we don't treat. So I guess I should back up and say like this clinic that we're at just now is now a full service clinic. They weren't always, but they've opened this clinic to be that community clinic available to folks that couldn't afford to go elsewhere, but primarily they were just doing like vaccines and skin things and ear infections. But I came in and I was like, no, I want to treat everything as best we can. And if we're able to. So I said, right, I have this diabetic dog that I'm calling labs back on. Like, you know, what can I do? And they're like, oh, well, yeah, we haven't treated diabetics. And I'm like, oh, well, if you can let me, I would happily treat the first one here. And so we did, and he's doing pretty well. I think this is, I've sent you, he was my case, Stinky.
Stinky. Oh, Stinky. But he wasn't straightforward. So that was a good first, not that straightforward diabetic. I love that though. Yes, Stinky. Yes. Brilliant.
Prior to me starting, they hadn't really done a lot of more critical or sick animals. It was a lot of vaccines and skin and ear cases. But I started with a callback about a diabetic patient that we sent a lot of blood work out. We do have in-house blood machines now, which is a new thing for them too. So anyway, called back on Stinky Carter, who I reached out to you about through the VTX advice credits, which is the most amazing thing I think available. it was so helpful. And so really helped to start their diabetic treatment protocol, you know, and which is such a fun, for me, it was such a cool turning point for my, you know, young-ish vet career so far, you know, to be able to help a clinic like start doing those sorts of things. And I used the Freestyle Libre on him many times. And it's like my favorite thing to do is to pop those on animals, because I'm like, well, owners know that it's not, you know, worst case scenario, it falls off. Like,
yeah, but I think, but what I love about that is, you know, we're talking about, you know, the Humane Society, you know, a subsidized veterinary care, but actually you are using continuous glucose monitors in these patients. And a lot of people would be like, oh, right, is that not like a really expensive thing to do? And actually, the thing is, the Freestyle Libre, there are ways of making that affordable. You know, people can buy their own bits off online and all that kind of stuff. So what I love is actually, that's a real, like, amazing kind of, actually, no, you can make it work and you can do it. And if people are dedicated and spending money in the right way, then actually, you know, it's not, there aren't as many limitations as you would think, right?
Right. And of course, you know, I mean, the diabetic patient is your classic, like, oh gosh, if they don't have money, how are they gonna, you know, care for this and treat this pet? And one of the things that I, in working with this nonprofit now, have come to learn, like, it's okay to have that conversation with an owner, which is something I feel like they don't, and I shouldn't say this in a way like, oh, I didn't get taught this, but like, I think it's this unsaid thing in vet school where it's like, well, what do you do if an owner can't afford, you know, this treatment or that treatment? And that's what I love most about having this rotation come through our clinic, is that I get to tell, you know, teach students and tell students like, right, this is what we would do, gold standard, but what's our plan B and C and D maybe, you know, if we can't afford these things. But like with the diabetic patients, you know, I will say, you know, if it's not something you can treat, if your pet is quite sick, like it's okay to have that conversation about, you know, humane euthanasia and things like that, which is something I have always struggled with, but you know, no one likes to have to recommend that or suggest that, but we know it's for good reason when we do. And so it's been quite nice though, to have those patients that owners are able to treat, and to monitor to the best of their abilities. And this particular owner is very motivated, almost to a fault, because she, I think where we last left it, the numbers were kind of on the higher side, but I was just like, at least they're not too low. So, you know, we're kind of in that fine balance of making sure he's okay.
Sometimes too much knowledge is a bad thing too, you know, like too many numbers, you know, I definitely have experienced that sort of on many occasions. But no, I think that's a really nice story actually, about just the possibilities are endless. It's about making it work. And I think through my own kind of work teaching, you know, often teaching gold standard, I'm very, very conscious of always saying, yeah, I mean, it's so easy for me to sit here and say, this is the thing you must do, but clearly that is not always the thing that is going to be the feasible, realistic thing to do. And I think we've got to kind of be absolutely kind of aware of that for sure. So I think it's really nice to kind of hear about your career journey, which again, you know, taken some sort of interesting turns and but got you to a place that, you know, and I just love that you and your husband came to do this vet school thing together and are like married. And you look very happy on Instagram, which must be a reflection of reality. So,
you know, you post the good stuff on Instagram, don't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, yeah, no, I'm joking, but that's,
it's
you know,
fun, yeah.
Yeah, it's nice that you have done that journey in some ways together. I really have a lot of respect for that. So, I wanted to ask you just to finish up a couple of questions that we like to ask, if that's okay. A few things. So if you, you know, you've made some massive commitments personally and financially to pursue your veterinary degree, if you were to go back to making that decision to, you know, move to Scotland and to do that again, would you make that same decision?
Oh, absolutely. I think when we first, for being a vet, you know, it's something I say to the students all the time, even when I have them, I'm like, oh, you know, it might look like I'm stressed or having a rough day, but I still would do it all over again. You know, cause I think we need, well, not that we need, but having more positivity in our field, you know, and reminding ourselves like, hey, I'm here for a reason. I wanted to do this for a reason. And this is my purpose. And it may be a struggle some days. And sometimes I might cry in the bathroom, but that's okay, because I'm going to wake up the next day. I'm going to save some more animals one way or another and help people, you know, in doing so. And then in, you know, of course I would go to Scotland again, obviously. That was probably the most wonderful place I've ever been. Mm. And it was just, I mean, Edinburgh is just such a magical city, I think. And so to be able to go to vet school there as well, I was so, so lucky and so fortunate. And then obviously being under, you know, your expertise and your learning.
Oh God.
And I always, I just constantly think back to, I had you and Danielle Gunmore on online internal bit. And I just, it was probably my favorite time. And I think it was Danielle that told, she's like, you should go into academia and do an internship and residency. And I was like, that is the best compliment I think I have ever received and will ever receive. So
yeah,
of course, I'm down that path, but maybe someday.
Yeah, I think, and actually for me, you know, I still, you know, I, you know, still fangirl over Danielle, you know, now we work, we, you know, we've written papers together and we've worked together, you know, in different ways now. But she, you know, for me, I get nervous and a bit like, kind of like, you know, when you were, you know, I'm sure the way I would be if I was meeting Adele or Lady Gaga or something, you know, I mean, like, I think that she still evokes that kind of like, there's something pretty special about her. And I think, you know, in a nice way, she's not an ego, but I think that it's nice when you know, working with people like that. So no, that, yeah, I have equally fond memories. If you know, we've touched on potentially inspiration, people like Danielle, just talking about that, you know, as far as the kind of, I suppose asking you about potentially people that have inspired you, not necessarily veterinary, but are there key people that have inspired you throughout your life or throughout your career?
You know, after hearing all the podcasts, I tried to think of a really, you know, perfect answer for this, but, and without sounding too cheesy, and I feel like I'm going to get all red when I say it, but actually Chris, my husband, he inspires me every day because we moved here without friends and family. We moved here and had a baby when he started his residency, and he has been able to not only take on that role as an anatomical pathologist, we kind of talked about, like, is shockingly stressful because I'm like, oh, well, your patients are all dead and you don't have to deal with clients. Like, what, how is this hard? Like, how is this stressful? But it is, I mean, being on the other side of it and seeing, you know, he's already gone through an exam, like the preliminary board exam that they have to pass to move on, and just to see him be able to study and then get up every day and go do this work and be having to teach students as well and get his reports done and correct theirs. And then also to be the most incredible dad on top of it. I'm just like, I don't know how he does it. And so I find inspiration with that every day, because certainly if it were me going through a residency, I think it would not be as, it would not be going as well, I don't think.
What? Well.
Yeah, I mean, we all ride.
Yeah, and I think I think you're right to you know, I have admiration for everyone doing a residency in whichever discipline, but I think you're underestimating yourself there, because I think you just have to find ways of,
right,
you know, but I do honestly have a slightly extra special bit of respect for people that make the terrible decision to have children during residencies.
And, you know, not only did we move to a new state where we didn't know anyone, but then, oh, we also bought a house and then had a baby. And it was like, and then the pandemic hit. And I was like, why did we do this all at the same time?
What have we done?
There's no perfect time, is there?
There's no. I think we were lucky, actually. I remember vividly sort of putting in the application, the adoption application, literally just as my residency was finishing. But we had that luxury of kind of being maybe more, a bit more, there was paperwork involved, we could make a very conscious timeline choice, you know. But I definitely made that decision. But I, you know, I've known a few people to have, you know, kids during residencies, and yeah, extra little bit of kind of respect for juggling that extra huge thing amongst everything else. No, so that's a good answer. We'll need to get him on the podcast. That'll be our next.
He's way more introverted than I am, and so, but he's, you know, great, still great to talk to, and you know, obviously teaches students, but it's, I think it's more of a push for him. He's got to, like, turn right after, you know, recharge. Yeah. I'm like, I could talk to people all day, every day, and just be fine. So
yeah, okay. So that would be his worst nightmare. Fine. Well, I'll not reach out to him then.
We'll ask. Back. I'll ask him tonight.
Yeah. So the couple of things, that one of the sort of I don't know, interesting questions that we get a variety of answers to that we've asked more recently is, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Oh, I love that. I think I have two answers for this. One, if I, you know, I would answer in this, the veterinary world, I would love to specialize in behavior, actually. It's something that I've grown to really appreciate and become very interested in. And then I have three dogs of my own that are all behavior nightmares. And so it's kind of triggered that interest in me as well. So I would be a behaviorist if I could, veterinary behaviorist, but completely not on the veterinary side. I would love to be a full-time artist, actually, like with drawing and painting and stuff. I used to do some pet portraits on the side to make some extra money before and after vet school, but definitely has been on the back burner recently. So I like to use that side of my brain every once in a while.
I love when, you know, it's really surprising. I love when people come out with stuff like that. And actually, you'd be surprised the number of people who come out with something that is more artistic, you know. So I personally was very torn between potentially the decision between drama school and vet school, you know. So that was on the cards for me personally. Yeah. So I, Yeah, well, I mean, okay, I get that a lot. But I think, but that was part of, you know, that was honestly like, you know, I remember my history teacher sitting down and going, you know, this could be a thing, you could do this too. And I was like, and I was pleased that I was in an environment where people were like, sort of, you know, happy to cultivate any option. You know, it was just about, you know, doing what you wanted to do. But the number, you know, we just today, I said, I was listening to the episode we did with Ebony Escalona, and she had done art and, you know, English as kind of her subjects and had not really thought about veterinary medicine. And actually, honestly, the number of people who've been like, oh yeah, something arty. And I'm like, that's amazing. You know, and I think actually one of the things I've said time and again, for me, although I'm not an artist, even doing VTX and creating or being part of creating a website or a logo or a brand or a something, like that's allowed me to use a different part of my brain that actually has given me some joy. So I think, and so actually using that, I'm sure it is another part of your brain that allows you to draw animals or whatever rather than treat them. So yeah, no, great. I think it's really important to kind of continue to do that in whichever way you can as well. Yeah.
For all the listeners that may still be at University of Edinburgh, you know, they had those, like we had the houses when I was there. That was like a thing that we did and I drew and designed the Alamure, I think was ours. I'm probably saying that wrong now. That was our house in vet school, right? They tried to make it Harry Potter. And then each person in the house nominated someone to draw, and anyway I drew ours, and it's I think it's still hanging in the vet school. So
wow, let's try and find a link to that we can put in the podcast show. I'd love to see that. Let's try and find that. That's very cool.
Yeah, I have the drawing, so if you need it. I mean, I have a picture of it, so.
Oh, let's try and find a way of sharing that. I would love to see that. Cool. I love, yeah, that people, it's important to cultivate the other sides of our personality. And if you were to, for the people listening, if you were to share one piece of advice with them, what would that piece of advice be?
Ooh, I think, well, for me anyway, in my journey through various practices that I've worked with, your first job does not have to be your permanent job, and to be able to find your niche in what you're doing. And as we were saying before, whether, you know, if you can find a practice that really allows you to be the vet that you want to be, you know, go for that. And yeah, just be able to find a place that makes you happy and also gives you good quality of life at the end of the day, you know, because you're more than just a vet. And so, as we were talking about, you have to do all these other things to make sure that, you know, you're happy deep down.
Yeah, good advice. Good advice. Find the right place. Find your lane. Find your, yeah. And it's much more than just the veterinary medicine itself. Well, listen, thank you so much for taking the time to chat to us today. We really truly appreciate it. I know how busy you are, and obviously our time difference has been challenging, but it's what a joy to chat to you. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. It's been awesome.
Okay, so in our clinical segment today, we're going to chat begin to chat about leptospirosis. And actually, what I think we'll do before kind of diving into what leptospirosis really is, I wanted to start off with a case, actually, and just kind of set this up by, you know, doing it through a kind of real life case. So I want to talk about Boo. Boo is a 5-year-old female neuter Springer Spaniel who has been wormed and sort of had preventative treatment regularly through her life, apart from vaccinations. So she only ever had her puppy vaccinations, so those kind of initial vaccinations at, you know, 10 and 12 weeks, whatever, and then hasn't been vaccinated since then. She's got no travel history. She's a Springer Spaniel who's out and about and likes to eat lots of dead things. She's a scavenger, and she's presenting with an acute onset of lethargy and anorexia, But actually a 3 to 4 week mild reduction in exercise. So she's maybe not been 100% for the last few weeks. And on examination, she's obviously jaundiced. So she has yellow pigment in her mucous membranes and her sclera. She's still relatively bright. You know, she's still sort of trotting around the exam room, and her general examination is normal otherwise. So I think, you know, there's a few things here that are concerning, obviously, particularly the jaundice. Other points to consider are that the owners have significant financial concerns. And so we are kind of thinking about that limitation. Limitation is maybe the wrong word. We're thinking about, we've got to take that into consideration. That's just, you know, the situations we find ourselves in. Bloods were taken for hematology and biochemistry, and actually they were sent off. We you know, they weren't able to be run immediately in that scenario, and actually the dog was sent home with some subcutaneous fluids and an antiemetic injection, so some meropenem or sirenia, and sent home again because that is what was appropriate for those owners in that scenario. The bloods came back the next day and they showed a significant azotemia. So creatinine and urea were both significantly increased. So was phosphorus, actually. There were some other electrolyte abnormalities. So sodium was a little bit decreased and potassium was a little bit decreased, kind of non-specific. We also saw a sort of mild increase in ALT, a moderate increase in ALP, and again, a moderate increase in GGT, as well as quite a significant increase in bilirubin. So overall, we had an azotemia, increases in liver enzymes and bilirubin, and some mild electrolyte abnormalities. So obviously, I've set up what this chat's about. So, but hopefully that kind of set of blood results would kind of start to, you know, ring some alarm bells with you. So the owners were actually considering euthanasia initially, but the Boo was then admitted for hospitalization. After some discussion, was given IV fluids overnight, and because of that combination of azotemia and liver enzyme increases, there was testing done for leptospirosis. That wasn't just because of the vaccination history being kind of lapse. I think it's important to remember that even in a fully vaccinated dog, leptospirosis is still a possibility. It doesn't completely rule out leptospirosis because you've got a complete vaccine history. But in this case, even more of a concern because that had lapsed. And the decision was made to do leptospirosis testing with PCR. And so blood and urine were submitted for leptospirosis testing, and we'll kind of crack this all open a bit more as we go through our discussion. The patient was started on amoxicillin clavulonic acid, and with the fluid therapy, the antibiotics, there was definitely an improvement overnight. We got back our PCR for leptospirosis, and remember, so that was PCR, looking for the organism itself in blood and urine. And the PCR was negative in the blood, but positive in the urine. We saw, so that there was indication there of leptospirosis. We saw an improvement in the azotemia in the first 24-hour period, and Boo was certainly much brighter. But that throws up a huge number of questions. So first of all, how should we treat leptospirosis? What's the best treatment option for leptospirosis? How should we monitor whether patients are actually getting better from leptospirosis? How long is leptospirosis shed for? It's obviously a zoonotic organism. How much should that concern us? Why was the urine PCR positive and blood PCR negative? The owners had a cat. Do we need to bother about the cat? There was two young children in the house. How much of a worry is that? And then the dog had peed all over the hospital and the clinical staff had come in contact with that, and how worried should we be about that? Now, we're not going to answer all of these questions today, but I wanted to kind of set up you thinking about these really important questions, because actually those are things that are genuine concerns when we're treating cases of possible leptospirosis. So let's go back to the beginning. So we've got, in this case, we've got a diagnosis of leptospirosis, but let's talk about what that kind of means. So leptospirosis ultimately is a zoonotic disease. So that's an important part of this, generally affecting mammals all over the world. So this is not, you know, it will vary a little bit depending on where you are, but certainly this is a disease that can affect mammals all over the world. We're most concerned in small animal practice with how it affects our dogs, but it can affect lots and lots of different species. It's a bacteria, it's a spirochete, a spiral bacteria. And there are over 250 pathogenic serovars. So there's lots and lots of different types of leptospirosis, some of which are concerning, some of which are not, but generally there's lots of them. And I think that's important to remember when we think about vaccination. I mean, yes, we might vaccinate against four types, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we're covering for all. And so there's many, many, many different types, and that will vary again a little bit on, you know, depending on geographic location. Leptospirosis will affect different animals in different ways, and that's really important. So we see, you know, some patients being really clinically affected, like dogs, and then actually some patients who can be infected with leptospirosis but don't seem to have the same clinical repercussions that, for instance, dogs do. And that a good example of that would be, you know, cats. Other reservoir hosts we see are rodents, and then some incidental hosts like cows. So lots of different species can be affected in lots of different ways. And what I thought was really fascinating when I was kind of reading up about this, you know, it's not just mammals. So there's even reports of turtles being affected by this. So Blanding's turtles are reported as a reservoir host for leptospirosis randomly. So it's not just mammals that we're talking about. So the epidemiology of this disease, ultimately our patients are getting this, or we are getting this, through mucous membranes or broken skin and contact usually with urine, to be honest. So and that's why, you know, we're finding our dogs getting it from splashing about in puddles and water where other animals may have urinated. My only experience of a colleague contracting leptospirosis from one of our patients was actually through some urine from a dog with leptospirosis splashing into her eye, which just shows you, I mean, it really does get in, you know, that way. Contaminated soil and water is really, you know, key. It's more prevalent at warmer parts of the year, when there is rainfall and flooding. Outdoor lifestyle, dogs that are kind of hunting, shooting, fishing, patients participants are more likely in some instances to get it. But I think, you know, don't be fooled, because actually, you know, we can see this isn't just a disease of working or hunting dogs. You know, we can see this in cities where there are puddles and where there are lots of rodents, you know. So just because you're a little dog dressed up as a unicorn wandering around the streets of New York does not mean that you're not going to get leptospirosis. Male dogs, working dogs and hounds, though, are definitely predisposed, but absolutely do not based on lifestyle, and do not exclude based on just stagnant water. There are actually reports of leptospirosis being spread when people go whitewater rafting, you know, where the water is clearly very fast flowing. So again, it's not just stagnant puddles of water that are at play here. When the organism gets into the body, then like most bacteria, it's going to spread hematogenously in the blood. But what's interesting about leptospirosis, it doesn't cause, when lots of bacterial organisms are in the blood, they're going to cause like fulminant septic disease while traveling in the bloodstream. And because of the type of organism that leptospirosis is, it doesn't really do that. So we do initially have leptospirosis in the bloodstream, but the body will mount an effective immune response. And actually then leptospirosis really only persists in what we call immune privileged sites, like the eye, the renal tubules, the kidney and the liver. So yes, there will be leptospirosis in the blood initially, but that doesn't last forever. And that's the reason actually that we, when we go back to one of our first questions, why was the PCR looking for the organism positive in the urine but not the blood? And the answer is because we've got over this leptospiremic phase, and actually the leptospirosis is now nice and safely compacted away in its various different sites, and so we're not seeing, we're getting a negative in the blood because we're not seeing that leptospiremic phase. I think it's important to think of leptospirosis as a multi-organ problem. You know, this is a problem that doesn't just affect the liver and the kidneys, the lungs, the spleen, the retina, skeletal and heart muscle, meninges, the pancreas, and even the genital tract. And the exact pathogenic mechanism is not fully understood. I think it's important to remember with any infectious disease, bacteria or other, just because you're infected with an infectious organism does not mean that you develop a disease. So there are various stages of that. So the body may completely clear leptospirosis from the body without any intervention. That's the end of it. You may end up with a subclinical infection. So the leptospirosis is there, but there's not fulminant clinical disease, or the body doesn't deal with it and you get the clinical signs that we're kind of used to seeing. The main pathogenic mechanisms really, excuse me, that translate into the clinical signs that we know and love are really to do with acute interstitial nephritis and tubular necrosis in the kidney, and also cholestatic hepatitis. So again, you know, involvement and disease within the liver and kidneys is still kind of front and center as far as the clinical signs that we're seeing. The clinical signs are, however, often non-specific, and in dogs, most likely to be related to acute renal and hepatic injury. And in our case that we started discussing, obviously with the liver involvement and the jaundice. But you can still see subclinical disease in dogs. Clinical signs may vary from the usual anorexia, vomiting, lethargy, abdominal pain, diarrhea, jaundice, dehydration, maybe even some musculoskeletal signs. They may or may not have a temperature, and they may or may not have respiratory signs. They can, but not always, are PUPD. And depending on the degree of renal involvement, they may have a reduction even in urine production in some cases. As I said, in cats, actually the clinical signs may be mild to none, but can potentially be all the same things that we discussed in dogs. Just generally, you know, not doing right, lethargic, as cats often are. But again, the clinical signs and the disease course in cats is just a lot less, significantly less significant. But also, we don't have a huge amount of studies in cats, so that's something that we need to maybe think about a bit more. It's really important to remember that leptospirosis does not just fall into, you know, the liver and kidney disease category. we can see leptospirosis affecting the liver without the kidneys and vice versa, although the majority of cases will have renal involvement. Some cases will cause more kind of chronic hepatitis. There are cases where we see respiratory compromise problems relating to coagulation even, and other cases, you know, to do with uveitis, cholecystitis. So lots of different presentations. There's even actually a couple of case series looking at small intestinal intussusception in cases of leptospirosis. They also had renal problems. But just to show you the kind of breadth of possible presenting signs with leptospirosis. So yes, they often follow the textbook and present with liver and kidney problems, but sometimes they don't. And I think it's important to remember that. So we'll leave it there for today, but we're going to pick it up next time with the kind of more specific diagnostics of leptospirosis, delve a little bit more into not just the hematology, biochemistry and urinalysis, but also the more specific PCR and serology testing. I do hope you enjoyed all of that discussion today with Kelly and regarding leptospirosis. We'll continue that chat in the next episode with our leptospirosis theme. I just want to say a massive thank you to all of you for taking the time to listen to the podcast. It really means a huge amount to me and to the VTX team. If you have any questions, then do drop me an email. For more information about VTX and what we do, then head over to the show notes of this episode and you'll find more information at www.vtx-cpd.com. So big thank you again, and I look forward to seeing you next time. Thank you. Bye.